considered it might make a quick announcement to remind the students about a meeting on Thursday in the union. It's for volunteering overseas, just while you set up.
Sure.
Okay, thanks, appreciate it.
Hi guys, really quick announcement while our professor is setting up the class. I just want to let you all know about a meeting that we're having this Thursday in the union. If you want to travel this summer, you have the opportunity to get academic credit going overseas with a group of students for a month this summer. To Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, South America, or Thailand. I see some of you guys have seen me already, but for those of you who haven't, hoping you all come down to one of the meetings. They're every hour on the hour, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Basically, the first 2 weeks is volunteering. You get to do things like teaching English to kids, helping build houses for homeless families, or working with endangered species like elephants, dolphins, cheetahs as well. The second 2 weeks, you get to travel all over your host country and participate in awesome adventure activities like whitewater rafting, glacier climbing, scuba diving, the Great Barrier Reef, and wildlife safaris as well. So if you guys want all the details, what I'll do is pass around this sheet of paper. So if you want to put your name and email address, I can email you after class with more information. And then grab one of the flyers off the back as well. So just pass them all the way back so everyone can grab one. And hope to see you guys all at one of the meetings on Thursday. Thanks.
Sheets for the labs. These are for INL. Everybody's here for INL, right? Just so we're on the same page. So I'm passing around sign-up sheets for the labs. We have 3 lab sessions. Please indicate all the sessions that you can attend. So I guess we haven't talked about the labs too much. The labs are your chance to do a little bit of practical work related to the material that we cover in this course. There is 3 lab sessions in weeks 4, 6, 8, and 10. The labs are not marked. They're mostly for your benefit to get up to speed with actually working with data. Labs will help you with the final assignment in this course. So if you want to do well in the coursework, labs is something that you should do. Okay, so It's a large class, so please indicate all the slots that you can make. Another announcement is the tutorials have started this week. Everyone is assigned to a tutorial group. If you don't know which group you're assigned to, please take a look at the course webpage. There's a link there to a grouping that basically tells you where and when your group meets. If you don't find your name on the list, talk to the ITO. If you find your name but you don't like the slot that you've been assigned to, talk to the ITO again. So they're in charge of all the changes. For the tutorials, so the sheet, the paper for the first tutorial is up. And the solutions will be up at the end of the week after all the tutorial groups have happened. So I think there is a total of 10 tutorial groups. So there should be plenty of slots that anyone can make. But again, if you have problems, talk to the ITO. Right. So last time. Charles was talking about the basic probability, and this is where we're going to pick up today. So let's see. Does anyone remember where we stopped last time? Did we talk about the multivariate Gaussians? Okay.
We're talking about the covariance.
The covariance, okay. All right. So
Well, I guess it's. I think it'll be useful to start a little bit before that slide. And let me just see if I can find chalk. So that will come useful because the slides are fairly cryptic in a few places. So let's think back. We talked about a univariate Gaussian, right? So that's a probability distribution that allows you to generate single numbers. So if you if your data comes in the form of a single number, a univariate Gaussian is sufficient. As soon as you have more than one, you're talking about a multivariate Gaussian. So Charles went through an example of a bivariate Gaussian and a specific case of it where the attributes, the numeric attributes, were independent of each other, right? So independence in probabilistic terms translates into a diagonal covariance matrix if you talk about the matrix notation, right? So so the matrix that we have there, the sigma, which has the sigma squared 1 and sigma squared 2 on the diagonal, that's your covariance matrix. And in the first example where we did the diagonal covariance matrix, that restricts your Gaussians to be axis-aligned ellipsoids. So what does that mean? That means that you're talking about two variables, x1 and x2, right? So a Gaussian is going to look like a bell, like a bump over that data. So things that observations that are closer to the center of the bump are more probable, and things on the fringe are less probable. But the constraint on this bump. So this bump doesn't have to be circular. It can be elliptical, right? It can be, as is shown in the cross-section over there, so the variance along the x1 dimension can be larger than the variance along the x2 dimension. But you cannot have this ellipsoid turned, right? It has to be elongated either along x1 or along x2, but not diagonally in any way, right? That's the limitation of keeping the covariance matrix diagonal and the variables independent of each other. So now, what if the variables are not independent? What if there is a non-diagonal covariance matrix? So first of all, what is the covariance matrix? Covariance matrix, it's a square matrix. It has as many rows and columns as you have attributes in your data. And each entry in the matrix tells you how correlated the two attributes are to each other, right? So let's do a bit of an example on this. Okay, so suppose I have a few data points. Scattered like that. This is my x1 attribute, this is my x2 attribute, so maybe this is the height and this is the weight if we're classifying people based on their dimensions. So these are individual people. So in this case, I will have a 2x2 covariance matrix, right? So 1, 2, 1, 2. And the diagonal entries are just the variances, right? So the variance itself, that's if you project all the points to the dimension and you see, well, what is the variance along that dimension, right? That gives me this. If I project to the x2 and measure the variance of those points, that gives me sigma 2. Now, what is this thing, sigma 1, 2 squared? That tells me roughly how correlated the two attributes are. And in this case, I can see that they're fairly correlated, right? So in general, when x1 has larger values, X2 has larger values as well. Now, how does that map to the equations for computing the covariance matrix? So suppose that this is not actually the origin. This is the point this is the point of the two means, right? So this is not zero. This is actually this is mu1, which is the mean of the average value of the first attribute, and this is mu2, average value of the second attribute, right? So this point is mu1, mu2, it's not 0, 0. So what are you doing when you're computing the covariance? The covariance, it's the expected value of, let's just take the sort of the ij. So it's the expected value of xi minus mu on j minus mu j. So what is the expectation? The expectation, it's there's nothing magical. This is just a sum that goes over all the points in your data, right? So I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 points. So for k equals 1 to 6, I'm going to sum up xik minus mu ik, xjk minus mu jk, right? And the I and j, I only have two of them, so let me just write them down. So what am I summing up? How does this translate into correlation? Why does this tell me anything about the correlation? Well, think about what I'm doing. So what I'm doing is I'm multiplying these things. This is the difference between the point and the mean. Okay? So let's take this point. This is the difference between the x1 attribute of this point and the mean, right? And this is the difference between the x2 attribute of this point and its mean. So it's like that. So what does that tell me? That tells me that for this particular point, as x1 increases, x2 increases as well. So the critical thing is that they have the same sign, right? X1 gets bigger and x2 gets bigger from the mean. Same thing for this point. X1 gets bigger and X2 gets bigger, right? So you can think of this as sort of a point that contributes positively to the covariance. This is another positive point. Now this is a negative point. So why is that negative? That's because the X1 value actually decreases from the mean, but X2 value increases from the mean, right? So in this case, if this is height and this is weight, so this is a shorter person with a higher weight. So that tells you that it's not always the case that taller people have greater weight. So this is an example of a negative correlation. And overall, this covariance, what is it? It's just sort of an average. You can think of it as a count of how many positive little correlations did I have in my data versus how many negative little correlations did I have in my data. Right. So that's just an explanation of the covariance. Now, if you, the equations that you have here, they're actually generic equations. They're not tied to any particular, to a two-dimensional case. I did a two-dimensional case. It's just harder to draw anything more than two dimensions. But the equations, they work for ND. So if you're working in a higher dimensional space, if it's not just a bivariate, it's a multivariate Gaussian, then what you have up there at the top, this is the equation for the probability density of a multivariate Gaussian. So what is it? It's so P of x, that tells you that's the probability that we'll observe a particular vector of numeric values x, given that we have the mean, given that we have a Gaussian with mean mu and a covariance matrix sigma. So again, it's a little bit, the equation, especially in the matrix notation, may seem a little bit intimidating. I find it useful to sometimes write out what it would look like in a simple case, right? And this is not going to show anything profound. This will just make a connection between this equation and the way that you may have seen the Gaussian in the past. So let's just take a look at what we have there. So we have
So we have e to the minus 1/2, and then what do we have? We have x minus mu. So again, mu is the vector of the mean values, the average values for all the attributes. Transpose, then we have the inverse. Then we have the inverse of the covariance matrix, and then we have x minus mu again. Okay?
Right.
So what does this look like in matrix notation? So what is x minus mu? X minus mu, it's a vector. Suppose you have d attributes, right? So you have x1 minus mu1. Maybe this is the height of a person, so it's height minus the average height. X2 minus mu2, maybe this is the weight up minus the average weight. And then you have all the way down to xd minus mu d. So maybe this is the last attribute. Maybe this is the amount of money they're asking for if you're trying to decide if you want to give them a loan or not, right? So that's a column vector. What you have here is the same thing transposed, right? So it's a row vector that has the same exact entries, x1 minus mu1, that's one entry, x2 minus mu2, that's another entry all the way down to xd minus mu d. Okay. So, and what do we have in the middle? In the middle, we have this covariance matrix. It's the inverse of the covariance matrix. So it's actually, in the general case, it's very hard to write the values of what goes in there. So you know, you can write them generically, sort of mu1, 1 squared, mu1, 2, 2 squared, sigma d, d squared. So these are just the variances of the individual attributes, and every other entry here is a covariance. So for example, this, sigma 1, 2 squared, that's the covariance of the first attribute with the second attribute. So that's just the thing that we went through over there. Now suppose, let's sort of, for the case of an example, let's flop back to the case where this is diagonal, right? If this is diagonal, then the inverse of this is actually fairly simple. So you have just 1 over the variance in each case, and everything else is zeros, right? So what does this matrix product look like if you do that? It's fairly simple. You're taking the row of the data, right? The row vector corresponding to the data point minus the mean. You're multiplying it by the column, and what that is going to do is that is going to select just a single entry from this vector, right? So it's going to be x1 minus mu1. You're multiplying it by this value, and every other value is 0, right? So you get x1 minus mu1 divided by the variance of the first attribute. And every other value is going to be 0, okay? And then that is going to get multiplied by the column vector that you have over there, right? So when you multiply this by the column vector, it's only the first n element that gets multiplied together, right? So you have x1 minus mu1 here, right? And everything else is 0. So if you go through it, then what you end up with is this is going to be one component of the result. The next component of the result is going to be x2 minus mu2, x2 minus mu2, sigma 2, 2 squared. and so on, all the way down. And all of these components are added together under an exponential. Okay? So if you unfold it, if you have a summation under the exponential, that's the same thing as the product of the exponentials, right? So if I have exponential of these summations, xi minus mu I squared over sigma squared I, sum goes from 1 to d, that's the same thing as the product, I equals 1 to d, of the individual exponentials. So why did I do that? What's the point of that? The point of that was to show that if you start out with a diagonal covariance matrix, its inverse is going to be diagonal as well. And then if you do a multivariate Gaussian, what you end up with is you end up with a product of the individual Gaussians. So I forgot all the constants along the way, right? So there should be a minus sign and a half there. But you can substitute them back in and see that you are actually going to end up with a product of individual Gaussians over there. So there is nothing. There shouldn't be anything particularly scary about that notation. Right? So when you look at that, just imagine what happens with a diagonal covariance matrix, and then once you realize what's happening over there, see what happens if you add non-zero terms. So for example, if you add a non-zero component in here, what does that do? Well, that adds another part to the summation, and what does that part look like? That's that will involve the ith attribute and the jth attribute together. So you're not just multiplying together the marginals anymore. Okay. Now let's talk a little bit about the idea of generating data from distributions and just generative models in general. So the big idea there is that you have some data, you have some observations, and what you do in generative modeling, you try to describe a probabilistic process that could have generated that data. So what do you mean by that? Think of it as sort of a black box where you push a button and it spits out another possible observation. So if you're modeling people using a bivariate Gaussian, if you're modeling just the height and the weight, you push a button and out of that black box comes a pair of numbers, the height and the weight, the height and the weight. Right? So that's what the generative distribution is. So if you have a good generative distribution, the height-weight pairs that come out of it should be reasonable. They should correspond to the heights and weights that you expect to see for real persons. So for example, it shouldn't say a weight of 1 gram and a height of 10 meters simultaneously. That's not a plausible person. It's possible, there should be some probability for that, but it shouldn't happen very frequently. Normally you would expect people somewhere in the vicinity of 60 to 80 kilos and with heights under 2 meters for most of them, right? So If you have an accurate generative model, it should spit out pairs that look sensible. The problem that you want to solve in machine learning most of the time is the inverse problem. So it's not pushing the button and seeing what values come out. It's mostly you have observed a number of values and you want to see what sort of a distribution sits behind them. And you may already know how to estimate things using means, variances, methods of moments, things like that. But it's a good idea to go through a general principle for estimating distributions, for fitting these black boxes, these generative models, to the data that you observe. And a good principle for that is called the likelihood principle. And that basically says that whenever you have a set of data, you can have various models that explain this data. And good models will assign high probability to normal data and low probability to weird data. Now, now usually you don't have examples of weird data when you're dealing with a data set. You just have examples of good data. So what you do in that case is you select a model that gives the highest possible probability to that good data. So that's the maximum likelihood principle. So the likelihood itself in general is defined as just the product of the probabilities for the individual data points in your data set. So what you have on this slide is big D is the set of all the training data points that you have, right? So if I had six people in that example, that would have six, that data set would have 6 points, 6 instances. And then what I'm doing is for each instance, I'm computing the probability that this model M would assign to that instance, and I'm just multiplying it over and over and over for all the instances that I have in the training data, right? So what does that mean? So why does the likelihood turn into product? So it corresponds to an assumption of independence, but it's a different assumption of independence than what we'll be concerned about for most parts in this course. It's the assumption that the individual instances are independent of each other. So it's not a major assumption. It basically means that if you have a black box that spits out different characteristics for people, every time you push a button, it generates an independent sample. It generates sort of an individual or an instance that doesn't depend on all the other instances that you have seen previously, right? So this independence assumption is very different from assuming independence among the attributes, right? So in most data sets, this assumption actually holds. You can treat the data as sort of some independent samples from some underlying distribution. So how does this work in practice? Let's look at an example where you're modeling binary data. So what you have at the top there is a sequence of 20 binary values, zeros and ones, and we're going to assume that that's our data. Now, in this case, every data point is just a single number, right? It's either a zero or a one, quite simple. So how do you apply maximum likelihood here? Well, so what you think about is you think about what are the possible models, what are the possible distributions that could have produced this data. And the first one, the most obvious one, the simplest one perhaps, is this data comes from coin flips. So maybe I have a coin, and I don't know whether it's a biased or unbiased coin, and I flip this coin 10 times, and every time I see a head, I write down a one, and every time I see a tail, I write down a zero, right? So that is a model of the data. Why is it a model? Well, because I don't actually know where that data came from, but this is one model that I could use to sort of imagine, well, it could have come from that, right? And if I make that assumption, then I can actually calculate how probable, how possible, how likely is it that if I flip a coin 20 times, I would get that sequence of observations. Now, the coin, that's just one possible source of this type of data. What is another source? Well, I could, instead of flipping a coin, I could be throwing dice, right? So maybe I have a die, it has 6 faces, I roll it, and if it lands on one, then I write down a one. But if it lands on any other face, then I write down a zero, okay? That can produce a sequence of zeros and ones as well, right? It's a possibility. You could get this sequence of zeros and ones from rolling the die. So is that a better model or a worse model than the coin? So intuitively, you may think that the coin is somehow closer to that, but there is actually a formal way to show it a little bit below, right? Finally, I could say that another possible model is a double-headed coin, right? So that's a coin that whenever I throw it, it actually has heads on both. I think this corresponds to tails. So this is a this. Yeah. So this coin would have tails on both faces, right? So whichever way I throw it, I get a tail, right? So and I could imagine throwing that coin, and if it ever comes up heads, which it will not, then I will write a one. But if it comes up tails, then I will write a zero, right? So that's a silly model, and you can perhaps already see that this model cannot possibly produce that sequence, because there is no way for me to produce a one in that case. But it's a model nevertheless, and that's something that you can consider. And in general, these are just the three possible sources that could have produced that sequence of zeros and ones. You can imagine countless others. So maybe this is monkeys typing on typewriters, and you're looking at the first bit of the third letter that each monkey types, right? So there can be many possible ways in which this sequence could have been produced, right? So let's suppose you adopt a particular model, model M. What that model is going to do, because you're producing binary data, because there's two possible outcomes, the zero and the one, that model has to have a certain probability associated with a one coming up in the sequence and a zero coming up in the sequence. Remember, we're treating each one of them sort of independently of each other, right? And if you think about the likelihood of the data given the model, then, as we said, it decomposes fairly simply into the product, right? So what I'm going to do is the model, whatever model I have, it's going to assign a particular probability to each one and zero. And to get the likelihood, I just multiply them all together. So what does the likelihood look like for the three models that we talked about? So for the unbiased coin, that's the coin that comes up heads and tails equally, everything is simple. Why? So what is the probability that that we would write down a one? That's the same thing as the probability of a head, so that's one half, right? Probability for a zero, it's probability for a tail, that's one half again. So for this model, the probability of the entire sequence is just one half multiplied together 20 times, so that's 0.5 raised to the 20th power, okay? So, and if you convert it to decimal, that's, you know, 9.5 times 10 to the minus 7, small number. Curiously, if you produced another sequence of data, it would have exactly the same probability for an unbiased coin, right? Just keep that in mind. So it doesn't, for this model, it doesn't actually matter what the zeros and ones are, you always get the same number. Now, for the second model, the one where you roll the die, the situation is a little different. So there, you put a 1 only if the die comes up with a value of 1, right? And the probability of that happening is 1/6. So every time you have a 1 in the sequence, you have a probability of 1/6. Every time you have a 0, you have the probability of 5/6. Right? So that's a model that is much more likely to produce zeros than it is to produce ones. And if you compute the overall likelihood, you get 1/6 to the 9th. That's because there are 9 ones in that sequence, and 5/6 to the 11th because there's 11 zeros in that sequence. Right? And the overall number is smaller than the model M1 that we talked about. Now, what about model M3? That's trivial because the model M3, it can never ever produce a one, right? It's a coin that always comes up tails. So every time you see a tail or a zero, you have the probability of one, 100%. Every time you have a one, that corresponds to a probability of zero. So it's a product of 9 zeros and 11 ones. And that, of course, is a zero. Right? So from those three models, you can already go and try to see which one is the most reasonable. Right? You can pick the model that gives the highest probability to the data, and that, in this case, would be M1. So now, what if you wanted to... So those are just the three models. There's an infinite number of models that can produce this data, and each one will have a different likelihood. So the natural question is, if we're doing maximum likelihood, if we're looking for the best model to fit the data, which model gives the highest probability to the data that we have. And before we do this, it's actually useful to look at something. Okay. So what I have here is this is the graph of the likelihood as a function of the different values of the parameter theta. So theta is the probability that the model assigns to generating a one in the sequence, right? So you can imagine a model that's so the model M3, it's a model that sits right in this corner. It assigns probability of zero to a head. So you have a probability of zero for one appearing in the sequence. And the likelihood of the data, not surprisingly, is zero. The same is true on the other end, right? If I have all the model that can only produce if I have a model that can only produce heads, never produces a tail, that has a likelihood of zero again. And for every value in between, I have a certain value of likelihood. And those values will have a peak somewhere. Now, where are they going to have where are they going to have a peak? You may already know the answer, but you can actually it's interesting to go through it to go through the formulas. Because you can actually you can find the model, you can find the value theta that gives you the highest probability for the data. How do you do that? Well, you take the likelihood, it's a function of this parameter theta, and you can try to find the value of theta that gives an extreme value, right? How do you do that? Well, you take a derivative with respect to the parameter value, you set the derivative to zero, and you try to solve for it, right? So that's what we do in that's what we do here. So let's see what this is. This corresponds to. So the likelihood in this case, it's theta to the c. C is the number of ones that I have in the sequence. 1 minus theta, n minus c. That's the number of zeros that I have in the sequence. That's the probability that the model assigns to 1, the probability that the model assigns to 0. So now, usually you deal with log likelihood, so you take the log of that. That gives you c log theta plus m minus c log 1 minus theta. If you take a derivative of that, what do you get? So c is just a constant. Log theta, that gives you theta in the denominator, so that's c over theta. Again, log of 1 minus theta, it gives 1 minus theta in the denominator, n minus c at the top, but it also gives you a negative sign, right, because theta was negative here. So you get that. Now, you set that to 0, what do you get? You get c times 1 minus theta minus c times theta is 0, and that's c minus c theta. Zero. These two terms cancel out, and what you're left with is you're left with theta is c over n. So what is that? C is the number of ones that I had in the sequence. N is the total number of bits that I had in the sequence. So this is just the proportion of ones out of all possible elements. So that's sensible, right? So in that sequence I had, there were 9 ones, there were 11 zeros, so you don't quite expect a fair coin. You expect a coin that's a little bit biased towards the tails. And just how biased? Well, it's 11/20th towards the tail and 9/20th towards the heads, which is the result that you get from differentiating the likelihood, right? So hopefully that's fairly straightforward. All right, so let's move on to an example. So we talked about a binary example where you have zeros and ones. You can draw the same likelihood where you have more than two possible values, categorical values. So if you have if you have a categorical attribute that has k possible values, you tend to, usually you model this with a multinomial distribution where instead of one parameter theta for 0 or 1, you now have a parameter theta j for each possible outcome, right? So if you're modeling the color of the eyes of a particular person, and they could be blue or brown or green, then you would have theta of blue and theta of brown and theta of green for that particular attribute, and all of the probabilities should sum to 1 over all the possible values that you want to do. So it turns out that in that case, if you have some observations of people with different eye color, you can compute the maximum likelihood estimate in a way that is very similar to what we did for the binomial case, right? So you just take ni, which is how many times, so if I corresponds to brown eyes, ni is how many people I had with brown eyes in my data set, n is the total number of people in my data set. So the estimate is just the proportion of people with brown eyes, and that gives you the probability for that particular value, right? Very straightforward. So it's straightforward to see it intuitively. If you were to go ahead and prove it in the same way we did for a binomial, you'd be in for an unpleasant surprise. If you try to take the derivative and assign it to zero, you realize that you get strange degenerate solutions. What you have to do is you have to add Lagrange multipliers to make sure that all the probabilities add up to one. So that's one way to prove it. There is actually a second way to prove it, which is nicer and simpler. It's based on Jensen's inequality. You can actually, I shouldn't go there. I'm going to spend too much time on this. All right. So that was an example with categorical data. With categorical data, you either have a binomial distribution or a multinomial distribution. If you have real valued attributes, you can compute a maximum likelihood fit to the data in largely the same way. So how do you do that? In this case, let's assume you have a single Gaussian and you're just modeling a single number. So the numbers would be normally distributed. That means the xi, this is the value of the attribute for the ith data point in my training set. The p over there is just a normal distribution with mean mu and variance sigma squared. So if you take the log of that, a lot of the ugly components of the Gaussian, they cancel out and they sort of move over to the side to become a constant term. And what's left is basically the sum of the deviations from the mean normalized by the variance, right? So that's the log of the likelihood. If you differentiate it and set it to zero, and then try to find the values of mu and sigma that satisfy that setting, then you're going to end up with the following estimates. So what are those? And they are, you probably expect what they, you can probably say what they are already. So the mean of the distribution that best fits the data is just the sum of the values divided by the total number. What is that? So that's just the average value, right? So if I had a bunch of heights, the Gaussian distribution that best fits a certain set of heights is just the one where you take the mean to be the same as the average height of the person in your data set, right? Very straightforward, although not trivial to prove. The variance, again, is you just take the variance in your data. You see, so for each individual that you observe, you see how far away their height is from the average value. You average those, and that gives you an estimate. And that gives you an estimate for the variance of the distribution. So the note there, the sigma square is biased. That's because you can actually, this is the most natural way to compute it. It turns out that if you take a limit of that as n gets large and large, this doesn't converge to the true variance of the data. For it to converge, you would need to divide by n minus 1 instead of by n. All right. So that was for a univariate Gaussian. If you have a multivariate Gaussian, the equations are roughly the same. Only this time, what is different is you're dealing with vectors instead of individual values. Right. So in the univariate
Gaussian. The mean was just x1 plus x2 plus all the way down plus xn, right? Divided by n. So that was for the univariate case. For the multivariate case, I now, each one of my data points is a vector. So x11, x12, all the way down to x1d. And that goes for each one of them. So what I do is the same thing. I add up the vectors to get the average vector, to get the sum, and then divide by n to sort of get the mean. That's the vector that sits in the middle. And it's
the same equation to compute the covariance matrix. You just it roughly follows the same thing that we did here for the variance of a single attribute. All right, so let's look at a couple of examples. So this is a set of data points. If you go through maximum likelihood fitting, that's the Gaussian that you would get as a fit to the data. So the darker areas correspond to sort of to more density, to more probable regions, and the lighter areas correspond to less probable regions. So that's where you're less and less likely to get the points. Okay, and I think we're done. So we actually have 5 minutes to go, so let me start on the naive Bayes lecture and then we wrap up. All right. So the naive Bayes classifier, which is what the remaining 5 minutes and the next lecture is going to be about, is a very nice follow-on to the lecture on the probability distributions, because that's where they're used in the simplest sort of in the most raw form. So think about, we talked about the probability and estimation and generation and how do you compute the parameters. So let's go back to an application. In an application, we're going to be working on, we're going to be focusing on the classification task. So you have some instances X, and what we want to do is we want to predict some outputs Y. And Y, in this case, are going to be classes. So we're going to be predicting things like whether an email is ham or spam, or what the value of a handwritten digit is. Right? So X is what comes in. It's some sort of attributes, and they can be either numeric or categorical. We're going to discuss both cases. And Y is the output that you want to get out of your classifier. So naive Bayes is an example of a probabilistic classifier, and a probabilistic classifier is the one that tries to predict a class that is most probable for the given input data. So that seems like an obvious choice, but there are many classifiers that don't start with that criterion. In a probabilistic classifier, what you try to do is you try to compute the conditional probability of Y given the data that you see, right? So if I have a certain bitmap with something scribbled on it, that's my X, I want for every possible Y, for every possible value of the digit, I want to compute the probability. What is the probability that this bitmap, this scribble, represents digit 1 versus digit 2 versus digit 3? So I'm going to compute all of those probabilities, and then I'm going to take the output, the class, that has the highest probability given the data, right? That's what all the probabilistic classifiers do. Bayesian classifiers, it's a further restriction of the class. That's the classifiers that try to express that probability of a class in terms of the probability of the data itself. So you've already seen Bayes' rule. That's how you convert conditional probabilities from one direction to another. And that is the basis of the Bayesian classifier. It's not naive Bayes. This is generic Bayesian classification. So what do you do here? What we want is we want the probability of y given x, probability that this is digit 3 given the bitmap, given the bits, the black and white dots, or probability that you should give a loan given a particular set of inputs. And how are you going to do that? Well, you're going to do that in terms of three components with the Bayes rule. So one component is going to be the prior. So the prior, that is probability of y independent of x. So that tells you how